Babylon 5, at its core, is a five-year history, from this year to this year. But life continues in either direction. And the fans want to know what happened over here and what happened over here. And if there were things that could be done without messing up this story, I thought, well, let's show that part of it.
In my world, there are books, thousands of pages, about the power of one mind to change the universe.
Got it. It's right here. It's right here.
Do not thump the book of Shaquan. It is disrespectful.
This is still the Babylon Project podcast.
The year is 2021.
The place, the Babylon Project podcast.
Well, hello there, Babylon 5 fans. Welcome to our next exciting, and you know, actually, I think this one, I found this book fairly exciting at points. Episode of the Babylon Project podcast. This is Raul Wybera coming to you as always from the middle of somewhere with my good friends Jim Arrowood and JP Harvey. How are you two guys doing this fine evening, afternoon, day?
Yeah. Well, I guess I'm doing just fine.
Not morning, never morning.
Yeah.
How you doing, JP?
Me too. Fine. Fine here. Happy to be into this book and leaving the other books.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, Straczynski said the next batch of books would be better, so we'll see about this. Jim, what book are we talking about tonight?
Well, we are talking about book number 6 in the standalone books called Betrayals by S.M. Sterling.
Okay, well, that is a name that has a good reputation. I know he's done some Star Trek. The guy has been allowed to write in David Weber's Honorverse, short story. That puts him in the company of people like David Drake and Timothy Zahn. So that kind of sets some good expectations, at least.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see.
Indeed.
I'm almost wondering, should we just go ahead and jump straight into that summary and get ourselves set?
Sure, I can do that.
Archive. Access. Initiated.
When diplomats from the universe's two warring superpowers come to Babylon 5 for a peace summit, Captain Sheridan and the Earth Force personnel know that security is paramount. But a brilliant con woman is making plans of her own, plans for the ambassador of both the Centauri and the Narn. And in the belly of B5, the seeds of rebellion are being sown. A twin brother and sister, equally committed to their cause but divided by strategy, seek liberation for the planet Till. Then a Tiln exile is murdered and violence erupts on Babylon 5, its internal communications hopelessly scrambled. With rebels threatening to bathe the peace conference in blood and hostile warships approaching, Garibaldi must plot a rescue of Sheridan and the diplomats. But it may be too late. The Tiln have learned the art of destruction from masters, and for them, freedom is worth any price, even self-annihilation. Well, there it is.
That is from the back cover, correct?
Yes, that's from the back of the book.
Boy, oh boy, who wrote that?
hard to say. Probably some Dell executive who had nothing better to do.
Yeah. Hostile warships?
Yeah, I know.
Oh, no, I know. I'm not beginning. Folks, if you haven't read the books yet, this description sounds kind of like some of the patterns that we've seen in the other books. The reality is a little bit different.
Yeah, it is. It really is. Because, you know, the back of the book, once in a while, you read those little blurbs on the back of the book, and then you read the book, and then you read the blurb again, and they don't always quite run parallel to each other.
Yep.
Yep. Not a new problem. I remember as a kid, when I first got into science fiction, when it really hooked me, running to the library to grab the next anything I could find that looked interesting, and the combination of the picture on the cover, and you read the fly leaf, or you read the back of the book, and you go, yeah, this is it. And a quarter to a third of the way through the book, you're like, you go back and read the back again. It's like, I feel like, did I not understand what this was about? So, no surprise, I guess, that it still
happens. I'll tell you what, though, in all honesty, I would rather have a back cover that hooks me into a good book but is wrong than a back cover that pretty much blows the story for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a movie trailer, you know, some of the books and movies both. You get these trailers that just give away the whole dang thing.
All the best scenes in the movie are in the trailer.
They are the trailer. Yep.
Yes. That's every high point. Dang it. I could have just watched the trailer.
So, you know, I'd be willing to bet that JP has us some extra information on this book.
Oh, I'm sure he does.
I got a few, a few of the usual nuggets. So this was published in May of 96. You see all these books are kind of coming out relatively close to each other, this collection of novels. This one also by Dell, 278 pages. And this story is set in 2259. So if we map it against the TV show, this would have happened in season two, unspecified. The event that there were a lot of mentionings about to place this book, say that it happens prior to the effective destruction of the Narn homeworld by the Centauri.
Right.
I take that to mean not the literal obliteration of the planet, but as I recall, the Centauri were using mass drivers and...
The planetary bombardment.
They bombed the snot out of the homeworld. Yeah, so... but we don't, you know, when you look at the TV show, you don't necessarily know when it happened. You just at some point know that it happened.
Right.
So sometime in season two, and there you have it. Now, so that's where the story should fit. The book publication date lets us know that the author arguably would have seen or had access to the entire first two seasons and perhaps part of the third. I'm not saying that to set up criticism or anything. I'm just putting it into a framework that the readers can know kind of what he should have known and where it should have fallen in the known and very popular timeline. So that's the special nuggets. I didn't mention it, but it continues to be true. This book is technically not canon, but we've already kind of set it up to say that I think we all thought this was a much better book than some of the ones that preceded it.
You know, JP, in all honesty, this has actually got me interested in reading some more Sterling.
Sterling, yeah.
Yeah, and that's STIR.
I like the way he writes.
Yep. I have read some of his stuff in the past, obviously The Honor Harrington, which I'm a big fan of.
I haven't. I don't think I've read anything by Sterling.
I've wanted to read his Nantucket. Basically, the island of Nantucket starts hopping through time.
That's cool.
Yeah. He's got some... the Draka series is post-apocalyptic. I'm not a huge fan of that. He's got some military sci-fi, which, duh. Obviously, that's why was invited into the Honorverse.
Right.
And I think it was some of his military stuff that I read many, many years ago. He's been around for a while. I've never read the Scotty stories, though. I don't know. Have you read those, Jim?
You know, I don't think I've read those specifically. I know I have read something by Sterling in the past. I couldn't tell you what, but I do, you know, the name was very familiar.
Yep.
And I know.
And I remembered it being a positive. So I came in with good expectation.
Yeah, I know I didn't hate it, so.
Well, based on that, Raoul, how about this book, Sterling, by Sterling? What overall impressions, but starting thoughts?
Well, we do see some recurring themes that we've seen in the other books. Brand new species out of, you know, that just kind of shows up and goes away never to be heard of again. The non-imperialism theme, which is kind of showed up a few times now. I wonder if that's actually something that came out of the JMS Bible for the series. It's really never specified directly in the show itself, but it wouldn't be so, especially with some of the themes that come out in this book, wouldn't surprise me. Straczynski's low opinion of the press gets a little bit more here. And, you know, the tension between Michael and John continues to play out, which I wonder if that's also from Straczynski's Babylon 5 Bible. But I just didn't strike me as really consistent with the series. At least there are points where it occurred.
Yeah, I'd have to agree.
That said, this was much better than the last two books combined. The short of it is Sterling gave us a nice story. It actually fits into the mythology without damaging it. He was able to make me care about the main new characters, and this might throw some people off because of the different plot lines, but he did manage to get the plot lines to interweave appropriately. Though, if you really wanted to be honest, both the Larkin and McBride substories could have really been almost separate short stories of their own. Actually, you know, if you really want to think about it, and if you want something to kind of help you understand the structure of the book better, think of this book, don't think of it as a novel. Don't think of it as a novelization. Think of it as an anthology that consists of a novella and two short stories, and you'll have it. The Larkin and McBride pieces being the short story, and then the Tallinn being the novella. I think this was an actual good effort. I think it was a good book that did justice to the mythology.
Yeah, I thought the same. Much better than the last several. And probably one of the better ones of the whole group that we've read.
I would agree with that.
Your comment about an anthology with, you know, a novella and two short stories just helped me resolve one of my, I'll say complaints, not really a complaint, but I thought, like some of the other books, that there was more book here than there really was story. I think in previous book reviews I've said, you know, this would have been a great novella, or this would have been a good TV episode, but it's like it got stretched. But describing it that way takes some of the few little disconnected moments and actually makes the game. You know what? That makes a lot more sense to me. Like I said, I didn't think more book than story as critically on this one as I did of the others, but it just seemed like there were maybe moments where he lost his way a little, or there was an odd shift between sub stories and what turned you as the main story, but I like that a lot. It's a novella with two short stories associated with it. Story was pleasant. I didn't get jerked around or jerked out of the story. I didn't get lectured by an author.
Nope. Real good point.
Really neat. So the new species thing, I kind of have with the others and this one too, kind of look at it with a little bit of a cautious eye, because I want to feel like that plugs into the television show cleanly, and I'm not quite sure that happened here. It's okay, but Sterling, like some of these other guys, paint either potentially or really do paint sometimes events that it's just like there should have been a hint of this in the TV show. But I get it that, you know, even in our intro, we talk about, we have the audio clip of JMS saying that their story goes different directions in addition to the story, the main. So it's okay. It doesn't make me upset. But, you know, here with the Till and some pretty significant storytelling between them and this overhandedness of the Narn, which you would never really see in the TV show, but I guess it shouldn't be a surprise that it would be there. You know, that it just causes me pause on some of these novels.
I think we will see that concern of yours addressed in two of the next three, possibly three of the next three, but definitely two of the next three, as well as into the three trilogies.
Yeah. Now, to reinforce what I was saying, Sterling told the story comfortably enough or well enough that it didn't bug me. It was just an observation, whereas some of the previous authors, I felt like they were just reckless almost with the way they were trying to use an unknown race to tell a bad story. Sterling told a pretty good story. And there's an unknown, a new race woven in, but
and he actually needed the race for that story.
Yeah, it was good.
They weren't there just to be, hey, look what we came up with. It actually served a purpose.
And then on the common side, the familiar side, I'll call out, for me, I thought Garibaldi and Ivanova, the sound of those characters to me overall was, I thought, pretty good. Sheridan felt better than in some of the previous novels, but I thought he had a much shorter temper, or a different, his temper manifests differently as Sterling presents him to us as the Sheridan that I think we would have been familiar with by the time we're halfway or partway through season three. So it is what it is. We've seen this as a problem in the other novels. It wasn't really a problem here. Sheridan was recognizable. He was, you know,
for the most part, he felt like Sheridan. There were just a few cases where it kind of stuck out, where he was still a little bit, you know, that if you put it earlier in the season, I mean, he could have been, it just come in at the point where he was still a little bit stuffier.
Yep. And to me, that really manifests in the friction between him and Garibaldi. I felt like it wasn't quite right, but it didn't make me fall out of the story or anything.
No.
So that's what matters most. What did you think, Jim?
Well, just to answer a couple of things that you guys have brought up. Sheridan, he had an awful big plate full of escargot to deal with there. You know, and I can certainly understand why he was not having the best day. But you know, be that as it may, overall, I thought this was a far better book than the previous two we read. It was pleasantly refreshing because after four and five, I was kind of dreading going on. And,
yeah,
you know, and I just thought we were going to be puking all over these books the rest of the way through up until we get to nine, of course. And, it was really nice. I was entertained by it. I kept wanting to read it. And, you know, I thought though on, for my part, I thought it was just a little bit busy with the outside storylines. You know what I mean?
Yep, I know exactly what you mean. Jim, I was originally in that same kind of mindset that you were there.
Yeah.
And that's when I had that epiphany of a novella and two short stories.
Yeah, and I just have one more thing to say as far as the new race that we have on the station. Can I buy a vowel?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I didn't have a big problem with the book. I enjoyed it.
Uh-huh.
I found it curiously refreshing.
Curiously refreshing.
I wonder if we had read this one before the really bad ones, if our opinion of it would have been different. I mean, this felt like a breath of fresh air.
I don't think my opinion would have changed.
I'm not sure mine would have either, but I if it did, it wouldn't have been a dramatic change.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, after the last two, I had to make an effort to not judge harshly.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Because I was ready to just, okay, you know, hey, I couldn't finish this
thing. Here we go again.
And, you know, right from the start, it was a good book.
Yep. Yep. It brought us into the story well, and it took us out. I think it took us out of the story with elegance and class, but we'll get to that a little later. Right now, it's if nothing else, it sounds like we're all pretty much agreed on Sheridan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as far as the characters are concerned, if we want to shift to that. On the main characters, it was really Sheridan, Ivanova, and Garibaldi, to be honest, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Delenn and Franklin had the cameos. They weren't pointless cameos. I mean, they actually served purpose, but and then Londo and Jakar even were almost secondary characters, even though it was all about their peace process.
Well, kind of.
Now, the other problem I had with Sheridan was his nonchalance about the Talin. It didn't throw me out of the story entirely, because when you think of Clark and his Earth-centric focus, I can see exactly where Sheridan would be, you know, felt, but he's really not the too bad, too sad type. You know, his final action about trying to get, his final action in the book where he tries to get, not sanctuary, but, what's the word I'm looking for?
Diplomatic protection.
Yeah.
There's a word.
When he's trying to get, when he's getting that, for the Talin, that wouldn't have been as
refugee
status. Yeah. That would have actually been his starting point. That's where he would start, get the stuff at least to Earth Dome and take it from there, rather than an ending point. But being new, I can deal with it.
Yeah.
Ivanova and Garibaldi, actually, I thought their relationship was pretty much on the mark. The characters were accurate. I really could hear, I love JP's description there, I could hear the characters.
Huh.
And both the banter and the emotional support, I think, was really in character.
Mm-hmm.
What are your guys' thoughts on those main characters?
With Sheridan and Garibaldi, it seemed to be a running gag through the book. You know, Garibaldi would find something, and then Sheridan would chew him out for not telling him about it when Garibaldi just found out about it, you know. And it just seemed like that every time Garibaldi came in to talk to John, John was jumping on him for not letting him know things first. And to me, that was more humorous than anything else.
You know, Jim, you just hit on something that's worth a note. Because too many of those ended up with Sheridan smiling or something like that. So it makes you almost wonder if John was basically yanking Mike's chain.
Well, I don't know about that, but I just know that I had to chuckle every time Garibaldi walked into Sheridan's office, and I saw this coming, and it just made me crack up all the time.
It's funny you said that, Raul, because I thought I was wondering if Mike was tugging Sheridan's chain. So With our three views of this, it makes me really, it's like we could ask Sterling a question. It would be, were you writing this to be kind of quietly comical? Was that on purpose? Because we collectively seem to think this wasn't hostility as much as there might have been some tension between them, but we think each one of them was playing with the other
one. Yeah, it was one of those veiled things that you could, I guess you could take either way, or, you know, maybe Sterling wrote it that way and then said, well, let's just see who gets this kind of a thing. So
yeah,
I think all three of us got it from three different points of view.
Well, we'll say that's what he wanted to do, and we, and good for us.
Yeah.
Yep. Now, secondary characters. Okay. Honestly, I thought they were pretty much on track with the possible exception of Natoth. She seemed a little prone to histrionics, a little too emotional at points.
Yeah.
That didn't bug me, because as important as she is in the series, she's a secondary character. And so it didn't surprise me that we saw sort of a shade of a different Natoth here. Still, it was clearly the same character, though.
That is true.
Mm-hmm.
That is true. Anything on the recurring, the regular cast characters before we move on to some of the new characters brought in?
No, let's look at those new characters.
Yeah.
Okay. Elias Larkin. You know, this character really bothered me, which is good because he was supposed to. I mean, this guy was creepy, but he was well written from that disturbed psycho sort of view, and his
and really well, really,
yeah, really well.
He was a believable bad guy.
Yep, it's like, gods, I've actually known people like this.
yeah, me too. Right, your classic malcontent. There's nothing you can do to make this guy happy. Nothing will happen that he likes or agrees with, and he's just going to be upset no matter what you do.
He's determined to be miserable, and he looks for revenge.
I've worked with people like this all my life.
Yep. Okay, so we're pretty much agreed on that. Simona McBride, the Harcourt Fenton Mudd of the Babylon 5 universe, except she gets away with it. Actually, you could almost call her Angelina Degrees, if you're familiar with the stainless. Oh, someone here is familiar with Stainless Steel Rat. Except she's a little less, what's the word I'm looking for? Homicidal than Angelina?
Yeah, this one's more mercenary.
Yep.
She's looking to turn a buck.
But criminal mastermind.
I like this character a lot, and I wish we could get more of her.
Yeah. You know, her subplot was actually the weakest of the set.
Yeah.
But I like that character so much that I don't care. I like you, JP. I would take more of her.
Oh yeah. I love the way she was playing Londo and Jakar against off of each other. You know, looking for the highest bidder for something that nobody was really sure if it was authentic or not.
Yeah, no, that is one piece where I was saying it was weak. Her storyline was weak. Okay. Londo and Jakar really that stupid?
It comes up with one of them, right? Wasn't it? I think it was Londo, right? And Veer asks him or warns him, "Oh, how do you know these are authentic?" And
yeah.
And if I'm remembering wrong, it doesn't matter. It was one of those two. As they work through it, we hear that argument come up from the aide, and the answer was, you know, basically, I'll take the risk.
Right.
And there was a reason given, and it was a good reason.
Both aides were concerned.
Yeah. But we got an explanation from at least one of the principals on why we were shown that they had thought about that, and it's okay if they're fake. That was credit to Sterling. I mean,
he definitely
he did well with these guys, and And that could have been just a monster plot hole. But he addressed it.
He addressed it. He didn't leave it. Though, just her cutting out. This is a character, you know, not so much with Londo and Jakar. And I don't mean this from, you know, shipping or anything like that. But I would have loved to seen a little, you know, to someday see, you know, have seen a new story or something where her and Garibaldi's paths crossed again.
Yeah.
I mean, he's the one person who got her right off the bat, right out of the gate.
Yeah.
She tried to play with him a little bit and he kind of shut it down. You know, he played back, but he let her know, I know exactly what you are.
I know exactly what you are. I know exactly what you're doing. And if you give me an excuse, I'm going to nail you to the wall.
Mm.
Yep.
And she was good enough to not give him an excuse that time.
Yeah. Yeah, she got away this time. So, you know.
Yep.
Doors opened on that.
That incident that you're bringing up, that was totally a misunderstanding. It was an accident.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he just goes like, all right, okay.
Yeah. Midori Kobayashi. Let's just say she was named correctly.
As in Kobayashi Maru?
You got it. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, this is where I think, as much as I liked McBride, this was probably the best character of the book. Even though in some ways she was kind of secondary.
Mm-hmm.
Secondary character. The development that he invested in her was enough to make you really care. Her death mattered. It hit you.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
You know, as
that was just good writing.
Yeah. You know, after that tea ceremony she shared with Delenn, you know, and
yep.
How deeply thoughtful she was and things like that. You bet. She would have been a great character to carry forward into the future.
Mm-hmm.
The only problem is when the end of the novel comes, everything has to be reset.
Reset.
So you can't keep around a really beloved character like that, which is kind of sad.
I know. When I said that bit about a really classy leaving the story at the end, that was exactly what I was talking about. That was just a great character, very well written. My thought, JP, your thoughts on her?
No, agree, totally agree with everything you said. Like Samana, this is a character I could have seen a lot more of and would have been happy, but we have the novel problem that you mentioned. Yeah. Jim.
Mm-hmm.
You can't introduce an enduring character in a novel like this.
Yeah.
Yep. I'll take Londo's approach on his nephew Sodev. Who cares?
Yeah.
Who cares?
Although I thought it was kind of interesting that he appeared in this. You know, I wasn't offended by it. And
no,
but you know, it was kind of cool to have one of Londo's relatives pop in for a few moments.
Yeah. Londo's comment and all is almost one of my quote. It was one of my quote candidates. It's not what I'm going with. If you blow him out of space, basically, if you blow him out of space, the family will grieve for maybe five minutes, maybe six.
Yeah.
Yep.
Chancey Clark. I guess everyone in the Clark family is not bad after all, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I was pleasantly surprised by this girl.
Yeah.
She was perky.
Yeah. the character was, and wait for it, she was cute.
Yeah, she was perky. Yep. I liked her. Especially.
Lanier reference there.
Especially when she grabbed Lanier.
Yeah.
I am so sad that didn't go a little farther, because that would have been absolutely hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
Lanier was totally on board with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was a little flummoxed, but didn't seem to object too much.
No, it looked like he was ready to have fun, so.
Uh-huh.
I like that she was very aware of the baggage associated with her because of her dad.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't spend a ridiculous amount of time trying to say, I'm not my dad, I'm not my dad, I'm not my dad, trust me. She makes it clear she knows that baggage is there, and then she begins to...
That was President Clark's niece, I thought.
Or, yeah.
Her uncle.
Niece. Yep, I said daughter. That, you know, she announces that she's aware of this issue, this family baggage, but then she just is herself. And I think that, for me, that's what made me like the character was, you're okay.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You know,
I like the way Sterling did that. That was,
yep.
It was pretty cool.
Yep.
Yeah.
And the two primes. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And I was going to say, Jim. she had to be his niece because I don't think Sterling could have pulled off that storyline with her as his daughter.
Yeah.
So.
Yep. And then let's finish it up with the two primes. Fina and, okay, his sister, is that Olarason?
Olarison, I think is how I said
Olarison.
It.
Olarison?
Yeah.
Parquet. never mind. Most people listening probably aren't old enough to get that one.
Olio.
they were written, yeah. They were written up alien,
mm-hmm.
And how their psychology worked, you actually had to take a little bit of effort and time to get used to it. And I say that as a good thing, actually. And you know, up until the very end, you did not really know how they were going to turn out. You know, were they really victims? Were they the terrorists that the Narn claimed they were? You knew there was more, but their nature just kind of kept it hidden.
Yeah, they were definitely the oppressed race of the Narn, which makes me think, you know, through all of these books, good or bad, there's always been some background on the Narn showing them to be not quite as innocent as Jakar would have us believe in the overall story arc.
Right, and that's why I think it's out of the Bab 5 Bible.
Ah.
Thoughts, JP?
Nope.
Okay.
Pretty good. I have more to say about these guys later. Not mm-hmm. significant or more, but yeah, it's...
Yep. And there's been really not much to say about Tittle other than, you know, it served its purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So, Jim, I'm going to turn it over to you a bit.
Okay. So, we have a few storylines that we can discuss. We have the Centauri-Narn Peace Conference, which seems to be, in my mind at least, a very, very small part of this story. It's more of a backdrop or a mm-hmm. scrim than anything else.
Yeah, really. You're right.
Yeah, because we never really get to sit down at the table. However,
but we know the piece. We know if anything like that would have happened is going to be a fail. You know, it's going to be a fail to begin with, and the fact that it's such a minor deal here actually makes it easier to fit into the overall mythology of the series. Because obviously it wasn't that important.
One of the neat things it did facilitate Londo's remodel job of his quarters. And it didn't cost Londo anything.
That was a very Londo moment.
Yeah. You know, Londo is lining his apartment with all this plush stuff and pictures and curtains and drapes and all these other things. Well, all the other guys that are showing up for the peace conference are getting IKEA furniture, basically.
yeah.
This episode, by the way, is not brought to you by IKEA, so I just thought I'd throw that in. So I don't know. You know, I really enjoyed. I thought it was hilarious, Londo's taking advantage of the home world's money for making himself more comfortable. Any thoughts?
You said it. It's a very Londo moment.
Yeah.
It's almost, I mean, it's definitive Londo.
Yeah. So, you know, and now there's Larkin's incompetence and his hatred of Ivanova for calling him out on it.
Almost sounds like it wasn't specifically a hatred of any sort of authority. How dare you?
Yeah. But, you know, let's face it, he was just bad at the job, according to what I read.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I think Ivanova made, you know, brought up that, hey, maybe this guy should be doing something else.
Yeah, it wasn't like she was trying to get rid of him even, at least not from Earthforce. It's like, get this guy, you know, get the guy somewhere where he can actually do some good.
Well, and he didn't improve. He just kept on being a schmuck about the way he did his job. And then, of course, that was his motivation to basically try to terrorize Ivanova with false tapes about her brother.
Mm-hmm. Well, and he moved from being an irritant to being dangerous.
Yeah.
And well written, because he became a scary person. It was just like, this dork. You know, it's like, this guy is actually a bad person.
His tactics were scary, but, you know, I never really felt like he would directly do anything to anybody, but he was trying to destroy Ivanova with these made up tapes or made up stories that he came up with. And, you know, he was playing dirty, but I never really felt like Ivanova was in danger of being hurt.
Yep. He
psychological terrorism, basically.
He thought about it, right? He thought very threatening things, but yeah, none of that actually came out of him. It was, you know, he thought about killing her, having to kill her. And, you know, like, oh, this guy is a lunatic.
Yeah.
But he really comes off as the personality that, you know, you just don't know. Is he really going to go postal?
Yeah, well, that's true. You know, there was always that edge to it. So
yeah, if he didn't blow himself out into space, who knows?
Yeah. And did you guys feel like this was resolved awful early?
Two short stories in a novella.
Yeah. So I thought Sterling might have started down a path with this, intending something different, and the story went to the direction that it did, the story we read, and so he wrapped it up.
Yeah.
He went where the story
I wondered
led.
If that was supposed to serve a different purpose when he began writing the novel.
Yeah, because to me, you know, two-thirds of the way through the book, Larkin is gone. And it's like, well, why was that even in there? And so I was just a little bit puzzled by it.
He had the potential to be a much more sinister participant in the story, and it evaporated. But I assumed, and this goes back to the, like you said, the novella and short stories.
Two shorts.
I hadn't when I read it and thought those were disconnected pieces of the story, to me, this was a part of that, because I really thought that was going to go somewhere else, and it didn't. It just stopped.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a way, JP, what you're saying here makes me wonder, almost like if this had been originally an episode outline with the main plot story, and then then a couple of subplots.
It would
have fit the structure pretty well.
Yeah.
So then we get the Londo and Jakar bidding war over the eye of the Republic, I guess. That was comical.
Yep.
Yeah.
As she was going back and forth, and
you know, we never actually find out what that creature is either.
What was that?
We never really find out what that creature is that makes the duplicates, or, you know, or if it's using it as a, I don't know if it's a telepathic thingy or whatever, but we really don't find out what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we just kind of accept it as being whatever it is.
Which is fine. In fact, it takes a little skill to develop a story along those lines and do something like that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and
so I felt like we got to watch this primarily from Simona's perspective and not Londo or Jakar. I mean, we got to see their perspectives too, but it was kind of a fun ride to be looking over her shoulder for the most of this. I felt that way anyway. Like I was really looking over her shoulder much more than bouncing between three characters. And because I liked her character, I liked the way that he put that story together.
Yeah.
As we watched these two get used.
It was just fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, and of course thrown in there was constantly Natoth getting on Jakar's case about his tastes for human companionship, I guess I'll put it, and Veer getting all over Londo for his part in kind of the same thing. And
the same thing.
Yeah. And how, you know, their assistants were just reaffirming their normal appetites and trying to make them avoid that. Because after all, it's supposed to be a peace conference, and that's probably where they should be focused.
Garibaldi, his first thought about her was, "I'm being vamped."
Yes.
He knows it. He's going to throw her in the clink if he gives her a reason, but he's not going to hesitate about not enjoying it at the time.
Oh, no. He's way too streetwise to fall for something like that. So, yeah. And then we got suppression of the Tull by the Narn. And then, of course, the question from that adds into that from earlier, were they terrorists or were they just fighting back?
And it's left to us, right? It's really left to us as the readers to decide what we want that story to be.
Yeah.
You know, one of the takeaways for me with this the oppressiveness of the Narn, the brutishness of the Narn, even though they're visually depicted kind of, you know, animals anyway, or aggressors, or, you know, lizards or dragons or whatever. They don't look like a pleasant race, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in the show, at least for me, I always felt like while the Narn and the Centauri were obviously at war and were working out the resolution of that, that the Narn tended to be the victims. Also, to me, these characters all grew, right? They matured as the story went on. But, Jakar annoyed me in the TV show early on because he was such a whiny baby.
Yep.
And he became a phenomenal diplomat and all of that. Oddly, as he lost his ambassador status, he actually became an amazing ambassador.
Yeah.
But this
He was a better ambassador as a citizen, Jakar, than Ambassador Jakar, wasn't
right?
he?
Right. Maybe the pressure was off. But this thing that's happening where we're watching in these novels, the Narn are really ugly. They're really oppressive. They're imperial and they're violent.
They learned too well from the Centauri.
This is what occurred to me in this novel is the reason the Centauri and the Narn went to war in the first place, fueled by the fact that it's like two alpha dogs, right? They're the same.
Yep.
Below the surface, they're the same. you dress them up a little differently and you attribute different preferences or motives to them. But underneath, the reason that dog A attacked dog B is they're both alpha dogs.
Yeah.
And I can't stand having another. That's competition.
Yeah.
So if that's true, if that's a possibility in this universe, that I have learned that only because of the novels, in spite of the fact that so many of these so far have not been good. So that's a neat takeaway for me about this relationship between the Narn and the Centauri.
Yeah. Well, you know, and then of course there's the possibility that the Centauri saw the Narn behaving the way they did and just said, okay, we can't let this go on. You know, they're enslaving other races. They're doing all this. And this is a recurring theme throughout these books how oppressive the Narn are. And the Centauri just stepped up and said, no, this isn't going to happen anymore. And the Centauri didn't actually realize the Narn had resources to compete.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, you know, we never really did get the story of what was on between these two, did we? Between the Narn and the Centauri?
I don't think so.
They just always hated each other.
Right. It's a matter of fact. We accept it as the Babylon 5 story begins.
Yeah.
It's just there. It's a part of the environment.
You know, he's granting the reader intelligence.
Yeah. So
knowing the background.
So then how do you guys feel that the Tiln were depicted? Were they freedom fighters or were they terrorists? Or were they freedom fighters who felt they had to resort to terrorism in order to win their bid for freedom?
You know something? And I just came to this thought as we've been talking. Near the end, Larson says, "You wanted to kill my brother," Larson said in wondering tones. It was obvious that the Narn would do it again, offered the same chance. The Prime was sickened by a cold wave of disgust so profound it was almost physical. The hand holding the PPG snapped up. "You think she's about ready to kill," and I had to do a page turn at that point. "But I don't want to kill you," she said. Larson looked around the room at her own people, who looked confused and angry, at their frightened prisoners. "Any of you. Is this mercy or weakness?" she wondered, and sighed. "It's over," the Prime said. "Give them back their weapons." She handed her PPG to Sheridan.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Larson knew the answer to your question, Jim, until at that moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like he let the characters take them where they were going to go.
Yeah.
She was definitely going down that path.
Yeah.
Yeah. We weren't given the answer to that question, and I never came to a conclusion about it.
Yeah. Mm-mm.
It's just left there kind of cooking in my mind after the story ended. And I kind of figure that's what Sterling wanted. You know, this is the thing, one of the things you're left thinking about when the story is over.
So what role then did Natoth's murder of Prime Fina, did that touch off the feeling the Till had that they needed to react more violently than they had previously?
I think Fina was already going down that path to violence, though.
Yeah, but ill-equipped to do so, as we find, you know.
Like we see with Larkin, who thinks a lot of things but doesn't do a lot of things other than be a jerk. But he had all this potential to be dangerous. We don't know enough, I think, about these guys to know, is it the same thing? Are we seeing, is Larkin a shadow of these people? Or is it just, they're just not related to each other? I was a little surprised by Natoth's action.
So was I.
I didn't. I didn't expect
the degree of hatred.
Almost premeditated, you know, presented as a, well, I was attacked. I've been attacked twice. And then Knucklehead here showed up where he didn't belong. And, you know, it was just the, it all made sense, but it surprised me. It was like that. And I don't know if that is a, just a disconnect in what the author knew about what we all know about after all of the Babylon 5 story that we've gone through. Is that just a disconnect in the character? Or, you know, I don't know, but it did serve a purpose, though, to put a particular kind of focus back onto the primes. But I think Sterling needed an event like that to happen to make us ponder more the are you a freedom fighter or a terrorist problem.
Yeah.
Natoth isn't the story here. She's a tool in the plot to make us have to figure out, to think about Fina and Alorison, whatever. But, you know.
Yeah.
So I left not knowing what I thought about any of this. But like I mentioned earlier, I feel like this was a part of what Sterling was trying to do, is make us think about these kinds of things. Natoth was expendable to me as a character. She was used to do a thing that I thought was out of character. But it didn't matter, because that she wasn't the story.
That's true.
Yeah.
But, you know, as you say, she was out of character, and it seemed like Jakar just kind of endorsed everything she did too, you know.
Except interfering with McBride.
Natoth was an important enough character that I would have thought that Jakar would have been, you know, hey, think about what you're doing here. But who knows? There's a lot of dynamics in this that we probably won't even touch on because they are so veiled. So, you know, I'm having new thoughts every time we come up with something. It's like, oh, well, maybe this and maybe that. Geez, we'd be here all night. So, JP, I'm going to hand it off to you to talk about the themes.
We've covered some. You know, the new species thing we've seen before, as you mentioned, the low opinion of the press, tension with Clark resurfaces here, but through a surprisingly reasonable niece, which was kind of neat. Violence and strife on the station, and hostage taking. I'm kind of tired of that, frankly, but it was okay here, because maybe the rest of the story was just a better story. So it was palatable, I guess, but, we've seen that before. The Centauri and Narn hostility in the war and all that, obviously that's at the center of the point of the novel, this peace conference. And then, you know, I've brought it up, and you guys have brought it up, the Narn domination of other races, which I suggest may be a reason why the Narn and the Centauri were actually ever at war, is they're two alpha dogs. We don't really see that in the TV show, but we're getting more and more of it in the novels, that the Narn were as big a jerks as the Centauri, and maybe worse.
The Centauri, they were jerks to the Narns, but were they actually jerks overall? Because they obviously weren't, as far as humans were concerned. The Centauri was the first race that we encountered, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's right, because Londo was, or there were Centauri ambassadors on Earth when we encountered the Mimbari.
Yep.
We had already... So, yes, they were either the first or the first significant. Maybe. I don't know.
And they seemed to be benevolent. I mean, they were well thought of, right up until Londo got involved with Morden. And that's kind of when when they went downhill. But I was going to say...
And that
Go ahead.
Yeah. I would say that important thing that happens between Londo in particular, but really the Centauri leadership in general and the Shadows and Morden, that is a tragedy. That's a tragic story in here. It's not a, oh, look, there go the Centauri again, those morons. It was a horrible, tragic thing that happened with them. So, I think you're onto it. These guys are, I guess, what Rome would have been in the goodness of Rome. Try and say the Roman Empire was a wonderful thing, but it brought a lot of goodness in spite of itself. I always think of the Centauri as like Russians, but really they're probably more like Romans.
That could be. I was going to say earlier, yeah, too, the violence and strife on the station. At least we didn't have a station-wide riot in this book.
Riot, yes.
Yes.
That should have destroyed the station, and you have to sit and wonder, how did they get that put all back together before the next episode?
Right.
Yep. One thought I do want to toss in from the theme's perspective is with all three plots, there was sort of a common theme of the making of a monster. In the McBride case, it was more humorous than anything. But, we're talking the Long Con nailing her mark. But especially in the Larkin story and with the Talyn, it's like, what turns you into a monster? And where's the lines?
Mm.
Where's the lines you can't cross?
Yeah, or how far do you have to be pushed to cross that line?
To cross that line. Yeah. Yep. Especially like in the case of the Talyn, where at least their leader's like, okay, if I cross this line, there's no way to go back. I'm not crossing that final line.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, which actually, I guess, is a segue to some of the plot points.
Yes.
At least the favorite. I just brought it up. Like I said, we've talked about it already. I like the McBride storyline. Yeah. It was a good break from the heavier parts. I'm not going to go ahead and bring that piece up again, but my favorite plot point, that's easy. The whole Midori Kobayashi arc.
Mm.
We had a character that was brand new and introduced. It was, I've said this already, it was really developed in a way that made you care about her. And that clincher with the tea ceremony with the Mambari, that just nailed it.
Yeah.
And rather than just being yet another side story, because one of the things that kind of happened with me going through is, is she just an incidental character of this book? Is she just going to be a third side story? Where is he going with this character? Her character was critical to the resolution and the climax, and her death hurt. You felt it.
Oh yeah.
That quality of writing is what made that my favorite plot point.
Yeah, it was very, very skillfully written.
Uh-huh. JP, what about you?
I want to throw one in. We talked about it a little bit, but it resonated with me a lot. We all commented we've had these Larkins in our lives, right? Various times.
Yep.
We've worked with this kind of person. I really appreciated how well Sterling wrote that friction for Susan and how she dealt with that. This guy goes from being a poor performer to being incompetent to being potentially unstable and even dangerous. It was an odd side story, but it showed, if nothing else, a very different side of Ivanova that we don't get to normally see. Ivanova's God. Watching her wrestle with this kid, I just liked it. I really appreciated how Sterling showed us Susan's mm-hmm. frustration and, frankly, some caring for this guy that she could have just spaced, you know?
Yep.
She could have spaced him as opposed to
him doing it himself.
But I like that. I haven't seen that anywhere in the rest of any of the Babylon 5 stuff that we've looked, you know, any of the TV shows or the movies. So it was, I loved that little insight into Susan's character.
Mm.
That was a favorite for me. Not to undo the other stuff we've talked about, but I like that a lot. How about you, Jim?
Well, you know, Garibaldi, tell you what, you want to talk about a guy that was busier than a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs. He had so much to deal with. He had the peace conference. He was looking for the Tiln. He was supervising and training rookies. He had to deal with the Prime Fina's murder, keeping an eye on Samana's activities and helping Susan with Larkin. I mean, it was just, and on top of everything else, Sheridan was on his case because he wasn't reporting everything that happened on the station in a timely manner. You know, there was tension between them, but it struck me as humorous. And I got to say, that's my favorite point of plot with that. So, you know, I guess about all we got left now is quotes, huh? You know,
I had a few.
You know, I'm gonna go first this time in light of what I said with
it.
Garibaldi. And there's a scene where Garibaldi is looking at it was almost a Star Trek like scene where they're doing this hostage taking or hostage saving kind of a deal, and it starts out the book and it's a very intense scene and it's like, oh my goodness. And then all of a sudden it's over and in walks Garibaldi like Kirk. Right. And
yeah, at the Kobayashi Maru.
Yeah. And you find out that it's, oh, okay. It's just, you know, they're just training and play acting. And, you know, after that's all over, there's these newly minted security officers in training and, Garibaldi looks at him and, you know, he has a creeping depression depression nudged him as he looked at the earnest young faces before him. What I should say is, leave now, boys and girls, if you value your peace of mind, because you're going to see people at their very worst in this job, Garibaldi thought. Every day, over and over again, and absolutely everything has to be learned the hard way. Now, he didn't.
That's a good quote.
Yeah, he didn't say that out loud, but those were his inner thoughts as he looked at these young people going into a profession where you become jaded after a while. And you're suspicious of everybody. So anyway, that was.
It kind of puts you into mind. You know, that part there kind of puts you in the mind of a bunch of, you know, since this is kind of sort of naval/marine, but a bunch of midshipmen on the snotty cruise.
yeah. So that was mine. So it's up for grabs. Either one of you guys.
JP, I'll let you go next.
All right. I had technically three. It's really two though. That I wanted to highlight. The first was a description of Samana, who we've all talked about, you know, kind of being fond of that character. When we're told, here's a lady who enjoys the power of being beautiful just a little too much. And I thought, man, that was perfect. And then the other two, there was some verbiage between these two, but it was in the same part of the narrative of the story. And this has to do with the station itself, which, you know, I think there are a few shows out there. The one that comes to mind first is Firefly. Star Trek falls into this, at least for me, the original series, and Babylon 5. And where I'm going with this is that the ship or the station over time becomes a character.
Oh, yeah.
And I loved the Tiln, how they viewed the station. So here is this. Within the station, Olorasin admired the way the Grand Mall gave way to the huge corridors, then branched into smaller pathways as veins gave way to capillaries within a living body. "This place," she whispered to her brother, "is a miracle."
Hmm.
And I thought, that's the first time anyone has given, that I can think of, that kind of attention to the station as a character inside this story.
And that's been a long-running thought of yours, too.
Yeah. I mean, the show's called Babylon 5.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So I loved that quote. And so there was narrative between those two statements, but those two were the takeaway for me. So now, Raul.
Okay. I finally reached a decision.
Dun, 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 dun. Should we have a drum roll?
Instead of a file, there was a note inside of Londo's cake. And the note says, "Hi, baby. I've left the station, so don't bother looking for me. If you'd been nice to me, I'd have left you a little something worth at least half of what you gave me. I picked it up cheap, so I thought, why not? But you are a fink instead, so this is your punishment. Always remember, Londo, it's impossible to flim-flam an honest man. Not that I can vouch for that, since I've never met one. And neither will you if you stay in politics. So take your lumps and stay as sweet as you are, sugar. Thanks for the credits. Kiss, kiss, Samana." It was just like, yeah.
And there she goes. And
there she goes. That, more than anything else, gives you a character you really wish you would have been able to see again sometime.
Yeah.
Oh. You know, I kind of think we've got a lot of this talked out. I know this has been definitely one of the longer discussions of the books rather than, God's, can we get over this quick? In fact, I'll use that comment to just, you know, sort of segue into a closing thought of mine. I liked it. You know, I don't know if this counts as the first half of the book runs or if this is the second half that JMS, the first of the second half that JMS said was going to be promised he would give a little more attention to. We were given characters that we could care about. The author did something with them. And I had fun with it.
Well, I enjoyed the book for the most part. There were a couple of things I thought were a little weird. The Larkin storyline, I wasn't really sure why it was there. It didn't seem to advance the main storyline at all. But, you know, when we talked earlier, we kind of tied it in. I think Raul mentioned about monsters. We had three levels of monsters here, Larkin would have been the middle man, but he just seemed to be more of an annoyance for Ivanova than anything else. I liked Chancey Clark all the way around, and I was expecting a spoiled brat, but she seemed like a nice kid. And I think Sterling, though, he missed a chance to interject some hilarity into the story by not pursuing the relationship with Lanier that her and Lanier had. It just got kind of dropped, and I would have liked to have seen more of that. The book was very refreshing after what we went through with the previous two books, and the author didn't seem to have a political axe to grind here. He just wanted to tell a decent story, which he did. So,
yep, I agree with all of that.
So I'm going to give this a rating myself of...
Are we going to do ratings yet? Or?
Yeah, we might as well do our closing thoughts and rating. And I'm going to rate it a 3.5. I've been thinking that from the moment I finished reading.
Yeah.
I've been torn between a 3.5 and a 4. The easy way of describing it is the book was above average. If 3 is your average, this book was above average.
Yeah.
And ultimately it's going to be based on, am I going to ever read the, do I ever anticipate reading this book again. And unlike the other books so far, this one falls into the, you know, I just might.
Yeah.
I'll give it a 4.
A 4? You're going to give it a 4, huh?
I'll go ahead and give it the 4.
So my thoughts to wrap it up, like you guys, I enjoyed reading the story, especially after the last two that we read. I went into this thinking that it was, overall, it was an average story, not in a bad way, but we got to see a snapshot of business and life on the station that we didn't get to see in any of the other shows or novels. So I enjoyed that. I enjoyed the glimpse into part of Ivanova's personality. I mentioned that before. Until we had talked about this, this is still true, that this might have been a better TV episode than a book, but it wasn't written to be a TV episode, so that's not a criticism. I would have enjoyed watching this or a couple of episodes that went together that showed us these things we've talked about. And maybe that would have been a chance to develop some of the transient characters a little bit more that we all seem to like. Reading it, I was a little bored with it, but that also isn't a negative. It's actually a positive thing. I think that happened in part because of my initial perception of the disconnectedness, but you fixed that for me, Raul. The disconnectedness of the separate storylines in there. And I really think I found myself a little bored because I was not reading this book angry. And the last two books made me mad. I didn't appreciate what the author was doing. And I don't mean I didn't understand what the author was doing. I didn't like it. So this was almost, it's like when you're cold and you go out into the sun and there's moments of warmth and then you get sleepy, but that wasn't really what you wanted. But it's a consequence of relaxing. So back to the beginning, I enjoyed reading this story. I enjoyed not being angry at the author. And, for that, I gave it a 3.5 as well, which I think is the highest rating that I've given to any of these books so far.
Ah, well, that's not bad.
I think the next highest one was the first book we read, and I gave it a 3. I could be off. I'd have to go.
Yeah, that second book that was on 9, I think I gave a 3.
So our overall boom scale is a 3.67 out of 5. Right. So, and then I looked it up and found on Goodreads, it received a 3.28 from 173 people that rated it, which we're right in line with that, I would say. And Amazon showed a 4.4 with only 12 ratings. Huh. So, you know, we're right in the middle of that range between 3.28 and 4.4.
Yeah.
So I would.
Good place awesome. To be.
So I guess we got it.
We were sort of alone and unafraid with some of the earlier ones, but right, we've lined up with the mass of readers who have written reviews or at least given star ratings or whatever. That's neat.
So, yeah, I still got to wonder about those fours and fives on those last two books we read before this one. There's just no idea unless someone stamp Babylon 5 on something and somebody's going to rate it a 5.
The fanboy factor.
Yeah.
Well, that was not a factor in me giving this a 4. In fact, if you really want to know what finally kicked it down. I've been rereading, do a combination. The last couple books I hadn't read yet, but I decided to do it with a complete reread of the Honor Harrington novels, which, hands down, best military sci-fi on the planet, in my opinion. During the course of these other books, I really resented the fact, because of the quality of the writing, I really resented the fact that I had to put the Honor Harrington series down to deal with those pieces of crap.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
This book, I didn't regret. I did not regret the diversion.
Yeah.
And considering that, you know, the Honor Harrington series is 14 books in the main story sequence, two four novel sub-series, if you want to, that tie very tightly into that main story, plus a handful, you know, a collection of short stories that some are more important than others. It for me, it felt more like a good quality break from Honor Harrington to take a look at this. So I felt good about taking the diversion instead of any upset or resentment.
Yeah. No, it was definitely a good book. Well, on our next very exciting episode of the Babylon Project podcast, we're going to be looking at book number 7 of these standalone novels. This one coming up is called The Shadow Within by Jeannie Cavelos, also the author of the Passing of the Technomages trilogy. So I am once again...
I know the Technomage trilogy was really good. I remember that being really good. I thought this actually was a pretty good book.
Yeah, I am anticipating better than average. So,
yeah, I think this one will turn out to be quite good for you.
Yeah. Well, that just
an Anna Sheridan story.
Yeah. That just begs the question for today. Did we have any boom?
We had some self-inflicted boom on Larkin.
Well, that wasn't
That's
so
too
much
small
of a,
to be...
that wasn't so much of a boom as a puff.
A puff.
Mm-hmm. But we did have a terrorist bomber boom himself. So yeah, we had some boom today.
Yeah.
Are we going to have boom tomorrow?
Definitely.
Definitely. Guarantee it.
Why?
Absolutely.
Why,
positively.
JP, are we going to have boom tomorrow?
There's always boom tomorrow.
Always.
Well, that's great.
Out. Good night, everybody.
So long, everyone. Say good night, JP.
Good night, JP.
Podcast terminated.
Thank you for listening to the Babylon Project podcast. You can email Raul and Jim at the Babylon Project podcast at gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook at the Babylon Project podcast. On the internet, we are at babylonprojectpodcast.wordpress.com. To subscribe to the podcast, you can find us on iTunes, or you can subscribe to the RSS feed on the webpage.